Hi, this is Alan Chartok. Joining us today is Ella Baff, the executive and artistic director of Jacob's Pillow, an international dance festival, professional school, and archives located in the Berkshires in Western Massachusetts. Under Ella Baff's leadership, Jacob's Pillow has expanded its artistic education and community programs, as well as its archives, scholars, fellows, and preservation programs, established a media and digital division, established the organization's first endowment, cash reserve, and capital reserve, and expanded the campus and commissioned a master plan for its now 225 acres. That's a lot. In 2003, Jacob's Pillow was designated a National Historic Landmark, and in 2011, Ms. Baff accepted the National Medal of Arts on behalf of the pillow from President Barack Obama at the White House. However, I've asked Ella to join us today because she's leaving the pillow to take on a new role as Senior Program Officer of Arts and Cultural Heritage for the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. We'll talk to Ella Baff about all of this and more. But first, welcome, Ella.
Hello. Nice to see you.
Well, you've been a big part of our past. How many times have we been on the radio together? How many times have we talked about
that? Not enough. It's so enjoyable.
It's never enough. The magnificent work that you've done at Jacob's Pillow. Look, you were preceded by a number of wonderful people, but you've really put it on a solid financial track. How did you do that?
Hard work, a lot of people joining together for a common purpose. I'll go back to the first thing I said, hard work. Planning, strategy, conceiving of an idea of the pillow in fulfillment of its mission, which is multi-layered and kind of an extraordinary mission, really, a mission that I love and respect and obviously feel very passionate about. And it was a joining together of purpose by many people.
A big part of being able to raise money in this environment is who sits on a board for your organization,
yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely key. Very, very critical.
Did you have to go get them?
Some of them. Some of them were there when I started. Yeah. Amazing people who had an abiding commitment to the organization. The Strasslers, the Chrismans, you know, Jack and Betty Fontaine, the Hunter family. I mean, really amazing people who are sort of pillars of our community.
And pillars of the pillow.
When I say exactly, and bolsters of the pillow. But when I say that, you know, when I say those names to certain people who are listening to this now, they know what I mean. They
sure.
know that there's a lot of meaning behind those people. But then, yes, we had to get many new people onto the board because you have to refresh the vital organs of an organization. So that's what we did over time. And now we have a very, very different kind of board than we had when I got there.
What's the difference?
But still with passing on of tradition, you know, a lot of what the pillow is about, of course, because it started in the 1700s, really, as a family farm. So, you know, there's tremendous sense of tradition.
Where does the word pillow come from?
It's a good story. It's a biblical reference. A lot of people actually ask me that because it's a little like Haagen-Dazs. What is it? Is it made up? But everybody remembers the name. So it's a biblical reference, the story of Jacob in Genesis. So if you look at the Jacob's Ladder Road, which had already been named, it's a switchback road. I think it ran from Stockbridge to Albany, if I remember correctly. And visualizing it from above, it looks like a ladder. So that invoked the reference to the story of Jacob. He had a vision. He laid his head on a bed of stones and had a vision of angels going up and down this ladder. And he had this extraordinary vision. And so the Carter family and some descendants of them are still in the area, I'm pretty sure, because I know that they were a few years ago, decided that they would work off of that amazing sort of metaphor and the reference, the biblical reference, the sort of religious-minded New Englanders. And so they decided to name this farm that they homesteaded Jacob's Pillow because they found a sort of fluffy big rock on the property, and they built the farmhouse about 1790. The rock is still there. That became Jacob's Pillow. When Ted Shawn, the founder of the pillow in the modern day in the early 1930s, bought this abandoned, then abandoned farm, it had been abandoned for about 50 years, he said, "This is where I will rest. This is where I will have my retreat for my men dancers." It's a very radical idea at the time. "And I will have my vision here." He kept the name in honor of that beautiful tradition and metaphor. And here it is today. And every company, every dance company that comes to Jacob's Pillow has their photograph taken on the rock. So there's sort of a documentation of that lineage of dance that goes way, way back. It's beautiful, beautiful thing.
I get that. We were just in Italy, and we went to the Leaning Tower of Pisa, and everybody wants to have the picture taken.
Did you take the picture leaning over?
Yeah, I did. I was leaning over parallel to
the classic picture.
Yeah, and then everybody's also stationed in such a way. They take iPhone pictures, so it looks like they're holding up the Leaning Tower.
Right.
Great fun.
I have one of those.
Great fun.
Too.
So there you are at all this place. I can't even imagine how you feel going from one organization to another one. Now, the new job is a terrific job, but you're giving something up.
Yes, I'm giving up something very big, very meaningful. You know, I've put 17 years of my life. I think anyone who runs an arts organization, let's broaden that out, anyone who's really committed to their work feels the same way, of course, you know, no matter what it is. You put your life into it. I've put my life into Jacob's Pillow. It's been a privilege. I've been happy to do it. It's been a great pleasure.
So where are you going?
To the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation in New York City. And Mellon, incidentally, has been a funder of the Pillow fairly consistently over the years. So thank you for that.
Is that how you got to know some of the players?
I got a phone call. It's such a sort of prosaic story in a way. I wasn't looking for a job at all, but I had always been interested in philanthropy.
But you were working the other side.
Yes, I was working the other side, raising money. But I always thought that the whole idea of philanthropy, especially in our particular culture, was compelling in some ways. And so knew a lot about foundations, either by raising money or just by knowing about them historically. So I got a phone call, and a new president came into the Mellon Foundation a couple of years ago, a noted social historian, an incredible guy. His name is Earl Lewis. And as happens with foundations and a lot of organizations, he created a new strategic plan with the vice president and with other people on the staff. And out of that came this idea that they would sort of combine other programs that had previously existed, stop funding certain things, start funding other things. And so they decided to create a position called Senior Program Officer for Arts and Cultural Heritage.
Translation, Chief Money Giver Outer for Arts and Culture.
Yes, they were going to call it that, but actually they're highly educated there, so they thought we better give it something with a little more je ne sais quoi. But yes, that's exactly what it is in reality. And so I will be working with, I already know, and what I don't know, I sense, some of the finest minds and generous people, generous of spirit, in the true spirit of philanthropy. You know, look it up in the dictionary, love of mankind, it says. And I think that for me, the same feeling of generosity that I have had around Jacob's Pillow and around sharing the art form of dance with the public is what I bring to the new job. It encompasses museums, performing arts centers. Art centers, there are special initiatives from the president and the vice president, Mariette Westermann, who's also a brilliant scholar. And so I'll be working on all kinds of things, sort of across departments as well as within my own department.
Well, that raises some interesting questions for me. I've been watching this philanthropy business for years when I worked at the Eagleton Institute of Politics at Rutgers years and years and years ago. There was an arrangement. The Ford Foundation gave them money almost every year, and they gave them lots of money. And one had the feeling, at least I did, maybe I was wrong, that they knew basically that they were going to give the money to the institution. And then they searched for reasons to give it to them. In other words, what the project was, they would earmark a certain amount of money and they would say, okay, now this is what we want. How do you avoid the same old people getting all the money all the time?
Well, there are always new people feeding into the system. And I think you also, you look at, I know this is sort of a cliche term, but it's a good one. It's descriptive. You look at the ecology, you know, of the field. And
what does that mean, ecology?
Well, it means that you have to allow for what is occurring occurring that is vital and interesting under the radar.
You've been doing that in with the dance for years.
Yes, exactly. So, you know, this translates very well. And also to provide some really stabilizing support to institutions that need them. So it's a little bit dangerous when funders get too, quote unquote, bored, because that's not what it's about. It's not about us. It's about supporting a field.
But Ella, if you're in charge of museums, giving money to museums,
yes,
we know who the major institutions are. You know,
yes,
the Metropolitan Museum of Art,
yes,
the Modern, the this and that,
yes,
and the other thing.
Yes.
And of course, there are always expectations on the part of all of those people that they're going to get.
You bet.
And then if they don't get for some reason, or even if they get less,
yes,
you know, you're going to have noses out of joint.
Yes. I don't know. There's nothing I can do about that, really.
Yeah, but how
I
do you
feel bad. Yeah. You
but
know,
how do you deal with that?
I mean, yeah,
how do
you? Well, you know, it's not all that different. I mean, it will be to another, you know, to the second power or whatever, because that's how philanthropy is. But again, you know, in one way, it's not that much different from being a presenter in a high visibility institution. There are so many artists who want to come to Jacob's Pillow because
right, right,
it's a very important, strategically important place. Not only is it a place where they just come and they enjoy it and they never want to leave, really,
sure,
truly. But it's also a very strategic location for them in terms of their career trajectory. So, and I have to say no.
Sure.
And it's part
even
of the
job.
Even
we have that in public radio.
I'll say you do. So, and you're very used to an enormous amount of public opinion, the good, the bad, the ugly.
Yeah, no, that's right.
But if you didn't feel sad, you know, some kind of, you know, personal feeling, and personal feelings are allowed as long as they don't cloud judgment. But if you didn't feel a little bit bad about saying no to people, then I don't think that would be a good disposition for a funder or a presenter or someone who is involved in work that is for the greater good.
Mm.
And so there is something about, you know, keeping a kind of moral compass on the thing that is, I think it's important. It informs the best judgment, whether it's an aesthetic judgment that one is making or giving money away.
You've always been known, Ella Baff, as a strong leader and as somebody, you know, who holds your own. Nobody pushes Ella Baff around.
Really?
I think that's fair to say. So where'd you get that from?
Where'd you get that from? No, I mean, where'd
well,
you get
I
that?
I know. Well, reputationally, I know who you are.
I know that you know so much about people and what people say about people.
Yeah.
So, you know, I'm a little, you're scaring me.
I didn't mean to scare you.
No.
I meant, in fact, Ella, to compliment you.
No, thank you.
Yeah.
I'll definitely take it as a compliment. How did I get that way?
Parents?
Well, can I just ask, how can you define strong?
Strong. You know your mind.
So I know how to answer.
You
really
were just
better.
You were just
just shy.
Saying that you know how to say no, and you have to stick with your opinion when you say no. That's strong. That's not
yeah.
easy. You don't get pushed around. I tend to get pushed around a little bit more, I think, than you do.
Do you think?
Yeah.
I don't know.
Well, yeah. I mean, I remember recently, not that long ago, some guy had written a book, which I don't want to get into, and mm-hmm. he hocked me, and finally, you know, I let him on.
It's a lot of pressure.
And my instinct was right.
Mm-hmm. It's a lot of pressure. But I think, but I do think that, you know, back to the idea of the rudder, you know, it's a daily practice, really, of, you know, focusing on something that is bigger than any of us.
Have you ever been wrong?
And
have you ever been wrong? Have you ever said, okay, you can't come because you're not good enough, and then you turn out to be world famous?
I'm thinking dead airspace here because I'm thinking, to give you an honest answer, I can't think of anybody at the moment, but that doesn't mean that it's not true.
So you're,
I just can't.
What I love about you is you're infallible.
No, hardly. But thank you.
Ella Baff, I guess I got to ask you this.
Yes.
I started with your parents. I gave you an easy opening. But what did they give you?
Oh, my goodness. You know, this is one of those things that ripens over time in such a beautiful way, you know.
As long as it doesn't ripen and stink.
No. 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 But would you like to talk about your parents?
No, but I'm doing the interview. So I talk about my parents enough.
My parents were really, really interesting people. To this day, they are two of among the most interesting people I've ever met. And boy, have I met a lot of interesting people. They were very, very creative. My mother was a shoe designer. She went to, she worked in France and in Italy a lot. I will give her an enormous amount of credit for taking my sister and I to all kinds of cultural events in New York and museums. And these are the things that you don't know of as a parent what and to what degree it's going to make an impression on your children. But you know that if you do what you think is important with them, eventually, it kind of makes sense. Sure. And sinks in and sometimes becomes like an epiphany years later. So that's what I have in a very real way from her in terms of my interest in world cultures. She was very interested in the world. She's very well-traveled. She was she had a lot of curiosity. My father had a lot of curiosity. He had a lot of psychological insight. We always used to tell him that he should have been a psychiatrist, which he wasn't.
What was he?
But, well, they were in business together,
I see.
Actually. They were in business together. So they were merchants / designers. Grew up in New York City. Then I moved to New Mexico.
Wait.
Yes.
You grew up in New York City?
I grew up in New York City.
Where'd you grow up?
76 between first and second. You see, when you talk about New York City, then it starts getting very specific. People will be laughing
well,
out there,
absolutely,
maybe in recognition.
Because the East Side isn't
any
good.
Block by block. And it's block by block and building by building pretty soon into the conversation. So 76 between first and second, and then 63rd between first and York.
Yeah.
And it was a fabulous experience in certain ways.
And you went to local schools or to private schools?
I went to Robert Wagner Junior High School. I went to Julia Richmond High School. Then I went to a private school my last year of high school. I left New York.
What was the private school?
It was called, I don't know if it exists anymore. It was on the Upper West Side, which is how I became really interested in the Upper West Side.
Do you remember the name of the school?
It was called the Baldwin School.
Yes, I remember that. Sure.
Yeah. It was a very progressive school, yeah, as I recall, where you could smoke in the schoolyard and call your teachers by their first names, which was, you know, really, it was pretty progressive for that time, you know.
That's great.
And that's how I got to know the Upper West Side.
And
real
then where'd
well.
You go to college?
I started out at the University of New Mexico. And arrived with a footlocker and a lot of curiosity about that part of America because I was very oriented towards New York and Europe, but I really didn't know that much about America. So I was reading books about the Southwest and Native American culture and history, and I was also very interested in cultural anthropology and in archaeology, which was the first thing that I wanted to be when I was a kid. I wanted to be an archaeologist. And so that somehow led me to New Mexico. I went to the University of New Mexico. Then ultimately I transferred to UC Berkeley. And that's where I graduated from, and that's how I got to the Bay Area.
Mm. I wanted to ask you a question about dance and what you do and how you program. You know, there's always this question. We've been talking a lot around here about Donald Trump and how the media has given too much attention to Donald Trump. And my answer to that is it's what the people want. Give them what they want. If they want to hear about Donald Trump, let them hear about Donald Trump.
I'm wincing. The radio audience, the listening audience can't see.
No, but
wincing,
I'm glad you're saying that because
yes.
can't stand the guy. Nevertheless, I'm letting our audience, in a way, dictate. We discuss Donald Trump in the morning or we discuss Donald Trump on the Vox Pop. Every phone is ringing off the hook.
Everybody, what should we do? We should form a Donald Trump support group.
Everybody,
I think there's a support group for
okay,
this.
Okay, now let's transfer this to
It's Ella Donald Trump addiction.
Let's transfer this to Ella Baff and the way she programs the pillow.
Yes.
You know, here comes, we were there the other night for your gala and it was great.
Thank you.
And it was, no, thank you. It was great. And I love the little Russian guy, the little Russian guy who reminded everybody of the greatest male, you know, dancers of all time.
Yeah,
and he
yeah.
could seem to be able to fly across the stage from
yes.
one end to the other without coming down.
It's true.
You know, just an astounding. What's his name?
Daniil Simkin.
He was fantastic. Well, okay. So here's a guy who clearly pleased everybody in that auditorium. Did you know that?
Yes.
You know, I had this co-counselor at Camp Bronx House, and there was always a dessert. And a dessert was you could have a chocolate chip cookie and chocolate pudding. But this guy, my co-counselor, was a bit of a sadist. So he would put the chocolate chip cookie. Yeah, he was. So he put the chocolate chip cookie at the bottom of this cup. It fit the circumference perfectly. And then he put the chocolate pudding on top of it. And nobody wanted the kids didn't want the chocolate pudding because there was a rumor around that it had saltpeter in it and it would stop their whatever function.
This is elaborate and devious.
Very
and
much.
Sounds just like certain camp stories I've heard.
Very much so. Yes, probably here. Very much so. Okay, so do you do that too? In other words, do you put the chocolate chip cookie in there? If they want the chocolate chip cookie, then they got to watch something like Merce Cunningham that they may not like.
First of all, I have to tell you, before I came in here, I thought, is Alan going to bring up Merce Cunningham or not? Because
well, no,
I know that, yes.
He's difficult. No, he's difficult to understand.
Yes. You know what? It's really, let me see. I think what it's about is that when the pillow is, I see the pillow as the most giant and you're talking about chocolate pudding, I'll use the word delicious, welcoming place, entry point, gateway for people who know a tremendous amount about dance, which accounts for a certain part of our audience, and many people who know absolutely nothing about dance. This is part of the beauty of it.
I think you're implying I know nothing.
And no, I'll let you decide.
Fair enough.
But I think that the point, a lot of the point for me about the programming there, about the curatorial perspective, as people in the business say, is to show the public a very, very wide variety. So it's not really, I know in the music business, and maybe you just referred to this, it's something like you have a Mozart and a Beethoven and you put the Bartok or the, I don't know, Morton Feldman or fill in the blank for whatever might be a little more challenging for the audience to, you know, acoustically adjust to and mentally adjust to. And yes, that is a way of programming, but I don't really think of it quite like that. I don't think of any of it as, you know, you have to take your vitamins. I think of it as showing the world, the public, a huge variety of what dance is, because it is many, many, many different things. So I figure that if you see a lot of different kinds of it, you will develop a broad palette, and you will begin to appreciate the content behind all of those individual artists, the nuances of it, the variety. What makes ballet different from contemporary dance? What makes contemporary ballet different from classical ballet? What makes hip-hop important? What makes tap an amazing American art form? All of those things start being revealed. Of course, at the Pillow, we have so much contextual enrichment for the audience, too, with the archives and films and videos that you can access online as well as on site. We have talks before every performance. We have after-show talks with artists. There's so much that gives anyone, whether you know a lot about dance or very, very little about it, the sort of guidance in exercising their, you know, curiosity, really. That's really what it is. It's not so much about, you know, what one loves and doesn't love. And, of course, there are going to be things you love, things you really just wish you had the last hour of your life back. You know, it's art, right? But within that, and I think over and above that, all of that, is this whole idea that art is a terrific thing. It's not just that, you know, for me personally, it's not just that I love it. I believe in it. I believe in it.
Why?
It offers levels of experience that are as broad as, I guess, what nature offers. You know, when you go out in nature, I do tend to compare the two. You experience different things internally. You experience different things socially as a group. I mean, it's kind of a bizarre phenomenon in a way, but a very, one that goes back, you know, millennia, that people may be engaged as a group in a very focused activity as a community together for that period of time, you know. It opens up the mind, the eyes, the ears, all of the senses. These are things that are exercised when somebody either does art themselves, whether it's drawing or ballroom dancing or whatever it is, and also when people watch other people doing art. It is a completely different and level of engagement with the world and with the self. And so, I think that's so healthy and important and should be really tremendously valued, you know, and I think people do value it.
We're talking to Ella Baff, executive and artistic director of Jacob's Pillow, and about to take on a new role as senior program officer in arts and cultural heritage for the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. So let's see if I can go in a direction that you'll surely bristle at. There are some...
Oh, I can't wait.
There are some people who think, you know, that the artsy types, you know, can be condescending, can be, you know, I had a relative, and one day she asked me what I did, and I said I was pursuing a PhD in political science, and she said, oh, that's not the arts. So, you know...
I like the inflection. Oh, that's not the arts.
Exactly. So, and I think that you've proved this, actually, with your incredible work. The arts has a responsibility as a group to open the doors, to make the tent big enough so that everybody can come in.
You know, I wouldn't dispute the responsibility part of it, but I would say that that's what people in the arts love to do, believe in, and want to do.
Not all.
Really?
I mean, there's some art.
Oh,
there's
okay.
There are some art forms where...
I'm thinking.
There are some
yeah.
art forms where... I mean, look, the Metropolitan Opera, all of a sudden, you can read in English subtitles
yeah.
what's going on the stage.
Yes.
Huge. So that you have a sense of not being displaced, not being pushed out. You have a sense
right.
of
right.
that this is something that... So that there's an enhancement of that. You come out at the beginning of a Jacob's Pillow performance, and you often explain what it is that we're going to be seeing. And so that
yeah.
people have, you know, a sense of what that is.
Yeah.
You may have a phenomenal tap dancer
yeah.
come to Jacob's Pillow and the next time have somebody up on their toes,
yes.
You know, doing this. And that's basically outreach, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I actually try to avoid, you know, explaining in the sense that I want everybody to have their own experience, their own individual experience of what that performance
sure.
is about, for sure. But I think it's very helpful for people to have some guideposts. That's why we do the pre-performance talks with our scholars. And I always encourage people to really go and, you know, it may not change your opinion at all about your own experience of that performance, but it'll give you some context. It'll give you a little bit, you know, some handles for the work that you're about to see. And certainly, like with a lot of music or visual arts, you know, there is a lot of dance that's abstract.
Sure.
So I myself, who have been watching that art form for years and years and years, I sit there both enjoying just the wash of the experience come over me, and I don't sort of exercise myself about finding meaning, and you know, and then also at this and during the performance, in and out of my head during the performance, I'm trying to discern, you know, what it is that's going on. Why are those five people together over there, that one person over there? Why are they suddenly rolling on the floor and leaping? And what relationships are being built on stage? Are they a community? Are they separate and lonely individuals? What about the music? How's the music interacting with the movement? Is there music? And if not, why not? How is the lighting design or the costuming affecting this quote-unquote narrative of the piece? Is there kind of a beginning and a middle and an end to this thing in the way that one might expect in a conventional work like, you know, a story ballet? And if not, what is that about? I mean, part of the really, really interesting thing, the juicy part, is sitting there and just not pressuring yourself with the expectation that there is secret meaning and you're the only one in the room who doesn't get it, but everybody else does, because it's simply not true. And really allowing yourself to be relaxed and free enough to really experience the work, meaning one will be asking questions. There will be certain passages where you really can't puzzle out what's happening, but you'll probably think about it later. That in itself is a very interesting indication.
Or maybe there is no meaning. Maybe it's BS.
Sometimes, yes. And there's that, too.
Yeah, yeah. So Elabath.
I hope not too much of it at the pillow.
Let's talk about men. Let's talk about men and women and how they approach dance. I'm sure there are lots of men aficionados of dance. After all, the pillow was formed by a man.
Yes, Ted Shawn.
It was men dancing.
Yes.
Nevertheless, when I see it, I quite frequently, when I'm looking at it, and of course, this is all very Freudian, isn't it? I mean, we look at something and who we are, we take away from what we're seeing.
Absolutely.
But I see a lot of sex in a lot of sexual coupling, men and women, pas de deux, that kind of stuff. And I'm just one.
And I see.
And how long have you been feeling this?
And how long has this been happening?
Forever.
Good for you. That's what I said.
So the question is, how much of what is dance? This is an honesty question, obviously. It's a difficult one. Is sexual?
I think if it's meant to be sexual, then it is. So there's a literal part of that. But I think, we're talking about the body. We're usually talking about very interesting bodies on stage. And what people consider to be beautiful, of course, in the eye of the beholder, because there are a lot of different body types that one can see on stage. But nonetheless, no matter what they look like, we're always talking about the body. And now, Alan, you have opened the door.
Good. Good, because you seldom see.
I think that people tend to sexualize the body, even when it's not intended. But again, if that's your experience.
Well, you have a beautiful woman, a beautiful man. They're floating across the thing. They're holding each other. They're, as you said before, rolling around on the floor. They're doing this and that.
Right.
I mean, and a good part of what we know about men and women is that this, and man in some cases, women and women, is that, life is sexual. So I don't think we can avoid this. I mean, it's.
No, I think that's also one of the things that makes people uncomfortable about dance. Now we're getting into the.
That's
sort
what
of
I like about
the psychosocial aspects of, in the more psychological aspects here about, how people respond to dance in different ways. For some people, it makes them uncomfortable because there's maybe a little too much of the body on stage.
There are those people who think that.
Yes, I think. And some people don't. They feel it. I don't know that, some people articulate it because they know that that's what they're experiencing.
What do you mean,
I think
feel
for
it?
Other people, they just feel it, but they don't articulate it because they don't have a lot of psychological insight about it, and so they don't say it. But I can tell by what they're saying that they may be experiencing some kind of discomfort about seeing bodies, often bodies that have little clothing, on stage. It makes some people uncomfortable. Other people are perfectly relaxed about it, and it's the body. Everybody has one, and it doesn't make them feel anxious.
But they're almost always attractive bodies as opposed to unattractive bodies. I mean, if dance
I
is
think
life,
most people in an audience would say, it's a good thing I'm not up there. Right?
Yeah, but if life is, if dance is reflective of life, we don't see a lot of overweight people, dancing across the floor.
Well, one of the great choreographers who made a very big breakthrough in that area, and there have been others. We could talk about Anna Halperin and, astonishing people who have challenged the conventions and these sort of notions that you have to be the perfect ballerina and so on. But one of the greats was Bill T. Jones. And he had in his company Larry Goldhuber for many years. And Larry was a big man. And it evoked an enormous amount of reaction, everything from, thank God I can finally see somebody on stage who looks like me, tremendous self-identification, and other people who said, what? This is outrageous. And it was a fabulous, bold moment in dance. And I also think that, public opinion and opinion within the dance field has changed, too. I mean, I think everyone has become more egalitarian about their ideas.
I think that's true.
About this. Don't you think?
Yeah, very much so.
I think so.
I'm fascinated by this business of men and women. Every little girl, or what seems like every little girl, takes some kind of dancing lessons, right?
I think a lot of them do.
Yeah.
Still, absolutely.
But the men don't.
More men do than ever before.
But But basically,
I know what you're saying,
the men are going out to play baseball, and the girls are going to.
There is still the gender, yeah. There are still those that's still certainly happening. But again, I have to say, look at what we see happening in the culture: gender fluidity now.
That's true, but I guess my question is not yet.
Unprecedented.
Guess my question is not yet complete, which is that as men and women grow older, it's a term I use in politics a lot. Salience to women, dance is very salient. If you say to the women, all of whom have experienced this sort of thing in the beginning of their lives and going up through their lives, how important is dance? And you say 1 to 10, they're going to say 2 or 1. In other words, really huge.
Right.
Whereas men don't always feel that. Although, I have to say, personally, of all the art forms, the orchestra, you know, the dance has to me always been the one I like to go to the most. I think you get music and you get a performance.
Yes.
So you could shut your eyes if you wanted to, but, you know, it's
true. This is true. Yeah.
But I love it. But let's say, just for a second, your experience into the psychology of who comes to the dance, how you program it, how you attract people to come. How often, how much do you know that that you know, wives are dragging their husbands?
Anecdotally, I hear that from some people, and women are still, I think, the predominant ticket purchasers.
Interesting.
So that indicates something. I wouldn't call that a definitive scientific finding based on, you know, that one statement, but it might lead us to an assumption there.
So what do you make of it? In other words, how do you, Ella Baff, you know, the head of the whole thing, does it lead you to program in a particular way? In other words,
no.
I've been there many, many times. I don't see a lot of men-only dance.
Oh, we do have that.
I know you have it,
yes.
But I don't see it as a predominant part of what you do.
No, but why would I do that?
I don't know. Ted Shawn did it.
Well, that was Ted Shawn, and also Ted Shawn had a very specific point that he was trying to make, and this is why he was a brave person of his time, because in those days, truly, for a man to be a dancer, very unusual, for a man to have an all-men's dance company, forget about it, to have a retreat-like place for an all-men dance company toured the United States. He really suffered slings and arrows and tomatoes and who knows what else.
And he had been a married man, right?
And he was married to Ruth St. Denis. They never divorced, by the way. Uh-huh. They remained friends for, you know, lifelong friends. And I think that was a very genuine, from what I understand, very heartfelt, very genuine relationship in that sense.
How did the pillow evolve?
That was different. That was his mission. It was so much a part of his mission to make the public understand that there was a legitimate, respectable place for men as dancers in our culture.
But how did it get where it is now? Now it certainly isn't that.
The world changed, and then different people came in from, you know, there were different directors who came in, and they had different ideas, and it didn't grow from that particular seed of being a retreat. I mean, the history it did, but that wasn't their sole purpose. His sole purpose in the beginning was to have his own company of men dancers, and the pillow was a retreat for that.
Speaking,
and then it naturally grew from there, even during Shawn's time, of course.
Speaking of history, we just, as I said, came to the gala, and we were transfixed by the archives that you have developed there. And you've been talking about the history of Jacob's Pillow, and you can watch the history.
Yes.
And you go in there, you have a wonderful director, curator.
Director of preservation, Norton Owen.
Yes, he's a wonderful man.
Well, I could talk all day about just Norton and the archives. In fact, Norton just celebrated his 40th anniversary year at the Pillow, and we have named what was called the Reading Room, the Norton Owen Reading Room, in celebration of his amazing efforts just on behalf of the Pillow in the field. But I hope that everyone will come visit the Pillow and visit the archives. There's so much that you could learn in such a very interesting and fun and very relaxing way. Again, you don't need to know anything about dance. You don't even have to like it. You just come, I promise. And there we have films that go back. I think the oldest film we have actually is 1894. It's
no.
Native American dance film. But fast forward to Ted Shawn and his men dancers, anything that was recorded, we have. And we also have an enormous amount of photographs, trunks of costumes, films, videos. Of course, now, thanks to our fundraising efforts and in part to a fairly recent grant we got from the Andrew Mellon Foundation, we've been able to digitize many of the images that we have.
Can we go online and see them?
Yes. Jacob's Pillow Dance Interactive. Just Google it and you will be able to access the treasures of the archives and also surf your way around links that just keep revealing, and you can look up anything under an era, an artist name, genre, and it's an educational sort of game. I don't quite know, you know, I mean, I think that's descriptive. I'm not even sure. It's even better than that. I don't even know how to characterize it. It's just wonderful, and I've spent hours on it, and a lot of people do too, and they just go online from all over the world.
That's phenomenal.
It's fantastic. So we've made a lot of progress in the sort of, in the digital world, as they say. It's really great. But you can also come and see these things on site. You can just walk into the archives and say, what do you have on dance from Denmark? What happened to Jacob's Pillow in 1987? Can I see that performance that I missed a few days ago?
Oh, interesting. Are all the performances digitalized?
Everything is taped, HD.
That's fantastic.
Everything. And we also have these wonderful sort of oral histories that we've taped with astonishing people in our field, great artists who are really articulate, and you get to really know them as people in a very different way from seeing their work on the stage.
We're talking to Ella Baff, executive and artistic director of Jacob's Pillow, and about to take on a new role as senior program officer of arts and cultural heritage for the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Well, as you know, the archives are in Blake's barn, and Blake was the son late of Marge Champion.
Yes.
And Marge Champion, who I've always loved and known quite well, used to have her pet peeves also. And one of them was she didn't like women up on toes.
I understand. It's completely unnatural. It's a convention of, you know, ballet a couple of centuries ago. You know, some people are politically against the idea of women, you know, distorting their feet and standing on their toes. And I think it looks gorgeous, nonetheless.
Me too.
Especially when done well. But I totally understand why she would say that and why other people would say that too.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
Well,
but can I say one thing about Marge?
Of course.
Because I could be here for days talking about people who have given their heart and soul to the pillow. And and people who have given to the pillow, obviously materially, whether it's, you know, $25 or much, much more than that. But
what's the largest gift you ever got?
Let's see. Oh, we've gotten some $1 million gifts on occasion from a foundation. The Doris Duke Foundation gave us $1 million, which is why that studio was named after them in 1997-98, and some individuals on occasion. And boy, we need more of those.
As they say in the Berkshires, and so don't we.
Oh, you know it. I mean, boy, yeah. Do you know that intimately. But that's the way it happens. But the soul,
yes.
the people who have also given, you know, their time, every single board member, every staff person, their time, their energy, their intelligence. And really, I use that word soul because there's great, great spirit that holds that place up. And Marge Champion is certainly one of the people. She is one of the saints, you know, when they go marching in. Marge is going to be there in that number. For her contribution to dance in general, she was a board member at Jacob's Pillow. She's been part of it for a long time. And she gave the pillow Blake's Barn. She and Liz Thompson engineered that during Liz's time at the pillow. And it was a phenomenal gift that we all enjoy.
You know, this business of boards you just mentioned, I wanted to ask you a question. Have you ever had a board member who was there for what we call blood sport? In other words, my twin brother Lewis always talked about the occasional person, once in a century you might get, who just gets onto board to do dissonance and to be an angry person. Have you ever had to deal with that?
We don't allow it.
Well, when you don't
allow
it, when you don't allow it, you get somebody and then they're not there.
Join another club, but but not ours.
Yeah.
I mean, you really try and avoid that, you know. The poison apple. No. I've been very fortunate to work with very good-hearted people who are actually, you know, they have a great deal of feeling for the place.
What if they try to call in the place? In other words, if they say, I'll give you $100 million, but you have to do it with the way I want you to do it.
No, you know, people have asked me that, the sort of, you know, the question about the Koch brothers giving $100 million dollars, and then David Geffen across the plaza gave $100 million at Lincoln Center and so on. And, you know, the question comes up, of course, in our field, if so-and-so gave you, you know, if Attila the Hun gave you $100 million, would you, you know, fill in the blank? For me, no. It's the only answer I can give. Why would we do that? If it was something that was so against the fiber, against the grain of the place, would you do it?
No, of course not. And we have on occasion refused money because it comes with strings. I can remember one $50,000 thing. They wanted us to move the weather report, time of the weather report.
Well, I don't know. Is that? Yeah. I mean, you might consider it.
No, we didn't.
I mean, one considers things within reason, but you don't go against the compass of the organization. Otherwise, you're not what you are, right? And yeah,
I hate to say this to you.
You can tell I feel strongly about that.
Well, I hate to say this to you, but we only have about 9 minutes left
good
in this interview,
God.
And I'm concerned about it. I'll mention something, and then you give me as short an answer as you can.
Okay.
Inside, outside.
The series, the free outdoor series.
Yes. Why is that designed? What's that designed to do?
Ring everybody to dance. This is the egalitarian social space, free and open to the public. I love those words, free and open to the public. We have very old people there, teenagers, families, young people.
Now, these are performances.
Yes, these are performances, free performances on the outdoor stage, Wednesday through Saturday. You know, we do have over 200 free events at the Pillow.
Amazing.
So while, of course, one needs, you know, in these organizations, certainly in ours, we need people to buy tickets and
but
shop in the
smart.
Store, need at the cafe and so on. We are very, very committed to a giant amount of free things for the public. So that does include the archives when we were talking about that. It is free. We have talks. We have these free outdoor performances on the Henry Lear stage.
But it's smart, right? It's very smart. I'm sorry to say this to
you
because I know you're altruistic. But it's smart because once you get somebody involved, they're going to graduate from going to inside outside to probably going in.
Absolutely. One hopes. I mean, maybe they won't. No. Maybe they won't.
Maybe they can't.
But even if they didn't, even if you didn't think about it strategically in that way, even if they didn't, they will have had an experience of Jacob's Pillow. They will have had an experience of dance. They will have had an experience of seeing art in a community setting, in a beautiful place. Hey, we've done our job, you know?
Yeah, no. I do know. What was it like being in the White House when the organization was given the National Medal?
I still stumble over being able to really articulate it in a way that that does it justice, because it was one of those peak experiences of a life. First of all, it was the first dance presenting organization to ever receive the National Medal
of Arts. Is that right?
Arts, yes.
Wow.
And to get that phone call, a classic moment where I did think it was a joke when I got a call from the National Endowment, and they're the ones who make the call to say, you're going to the White House to accept this.
You didn't say I'm busy that day?
National Medal of the Arts, right. Sorry, I'm washing my hair.
Yeah.
And I really had to take a beat and, you know, think about whether or not this was a joke. However, it was very a serious honor indeed. And I was very proud, not just for the pillow, but because of what it represented for the arts and what it represented for dance, which, going back to the beginning of our conversation or somewhere in this wonderful hour, is a little bit low on the totem pole in terms of, you know, having access to funding and also being not as widely understood by the public as some of the other art forms are.
Let me ask you about, we only have 5 minutes left, it's killing me, but critics. Critics come, some of them know what they're talking about, some of them are blowing smoke.
Yeah, why is that?
Mm-hmm. I don't know. What do you, do you take it personally?
If
there's a negative...
Everyone knows that you can't, and that's what you say, and that's what you try and experience. It's not literally me dancing on stage, and it's not the work that I've created, so it's much less personal from that standpoint. I know a lot of artists who, you know, just don't read reviews. They don't care. It's good, it's bad. They don't want it to affect their work. And others who just, you know, run to the internet and see what, you know, the what WAMC had to say about the work or the New York Times or whatever. It's one person's opinion. You have to keep perspective about that.
Yeah,
it's
but they
sometimes
can, they
difficult
can affect the way in which tickets are sold.
Absolutely. It has tremendous power up, down, and in the most curious ways. I mean, everyone now the most recent example is a show like Spider-Man, you know, which was just, you know, skewered a lot by the critics and did blockbuster business. So, you know, the public is a confounding organism. It feels great when you get a great review, and it feels lousy when you get a bad review. And then the rest is having a philosophical attitude.
Have you ever in your life called up a critic and said, you know, you really don't know what you're talking about?
No, but I have had conversations with a couple of people sort of after the fact. And it, by the way, not necessarily about a performance of Jacob's Pillow, but about a performance that they wrote about that
right.
doesn't have anything
sure.
to do with us, and discussed it with them in a very frank manner.
Frank manner. Free and frank.
Yeah. Like, are you crazy? But, you know, some of the people who write about the arts are our colleagues. You know, I mean,
they've done it themselves. Some of them have
well,
done it.
Or they have very deep knowledge and about the field. You know, it's kind of exhausting to see it as an adversarial relationship and to draw those kinds of lines. I think there are some really great writers. I mean, from our community, Deborah Jowett. I can't talk about, you know, writing about dance or anything else without saying Deborah Jowett. I mean, she is one of the most respected, I wouldn't even say a critic, quote unquote. She's a writer and journalist, and she's really amazing. So, you know, if that's the standard of a kind of intelligence about writing about the arts, then, you know, the rest of it is, you know.
Well, Ella Baff, we're sort of out of time. I want you to know how much we're going to miss you here. You've been a staple here on WAMC. And you're somebody who doesn't take guff, which I always have loved about you. You know, the pillow will be hard-pressed to find anybody as good as you. But, you know, life goes on, and I'm sure you'll help them out as much as you can as things go. Yeah,
absolutely. The pillow will go on, and it's an exceptional. I really have. It's sad for me to leave, obviously. I'm excited about the new job. But I have never, ever seen an organization that has the sort of history spirit that Jacob's Pillow has. It's compelling, and it's been a very, very big pleasure.
Are you sad?
Yes, you can hear it in my voice.
Yes.
Can I say something about WAMC?
Of course.
WAMC is another really important institution. So in my last moments, I'm going to... and I will continue to be in the Berkshires, but I think that all of the cultural institutions and WAMC, this is very, very important, and it's so meaningful when people support what it is that we do, and I have great respect for you and the station, so it's a sweet goodbye.
It is indeed. Our guest has been Ella Baff, executive and artistic director of Jacob's Pillow, and about to take on a new role as senior program officer of arts and cultural heritage for the Andrew W. Mellon Foundation. Ella, we wish you the best of luck. We know we don't have to because you'll do extraordinarily well as you have here in your new endeavor. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on the In Conversation with Alan series, or to order additional copies of this or any interview in the series, call 1-800-323-9262 or visit us on the web at wamc.org.